human being. It's rather something, you know, I want to boast and I want to show off, you know. So there's a lot of me within this individual that Allah has given me, isn't that?
Like you mentioned, one of the biggest mistakes that parents make in their life and when it comes to upbringing their children is the fact that they want to make mini copies of them.
Yeah, unfortunately,
right?
Yeah.
So like you said in the example, if you're a tennis player, you would want to make your son a tennis player, but better than you.
Right,
if you're a scholar, you would want your kids to be a scholar. So we kind of want them, we enforce our own agendas and our own ideology on that child. Where Amir al-Mu'minin, salamullah alayhi, clearly said, they are created for time different than you time. So they have their own mindset, they have everything different. They know they will never be us. They will always be better than us, maybe worse than us, but they have to make the choice, not that we make them who they are.
Right, so you give them, you provide with them the correct criteria, the Islamic criteria, for them to make those choices, right? So we can just give them the cup, right, and they choose what they fill it with, is it?
Well, not entirely. So we said, as parents, we have, you know, the package that has like certain things that responsibilities needs to be met. One is that we need to get the goal, the vision clear.
Right.
So our duty from childhood is to provide them with the right, proper Islamic upbringing. That's a must. And that's not us, though. So this Islamic upbringing is not mine. It's not your teaching. It's a teaching of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So Allah, imagine this. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you, if we can make this in a easier,
understandable
example, I give you a PC that has no Windows on it. And then
right.
I give you a USB or a CD. I say, right. Well, take these programs, install them on that PC.
Right.
Yeah, so your job is to do what? To install and merge the software with the hardware. Then you have a functioning computer.
Yeah.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given you that child as an amanah, as a gift. At the same time, he presented you with the
software.
Manual and
yeah.
the software. He says install. Right. So we need to embed this information in the child that he becomes a righteous, pious person. So this is our goal, first and foremost, when it comes to children. Now, when it comes to our expectation of them, because obviously, you know, raising them Islamic upbringing is one. Two, we have also to provide for the academia as well, because we can't just make them, you know, vegetables and them dumb people.
Yeah.
Obviously,
yeah.
We need to provide for them. And I think this is where parents seem to lose track of things.
Right. So they tend to lean towards one side and leave the other side, or completely lose both, you know. So we'll come back to that also. Please stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Welcome back. We're talking about how to mediate between the correct education, or, you know, the exposure that children need, and the Islamic upbringing and Islamic software, as Brother Abdullah said. What is this software? What is this Islamic upbringing that we've mentioned? We used this word. What is this precisely? Like, how do we get hold of this? You know, where do they sell it?
All right. So you're asking a question that requires many, many episodes. Now, the idea is that, see, Islam itself, it's a way of life, right?
Right.
It's a system that if you uphold, if you follow down to the teeth,
right,
you should be able to live a happy, prosperous life in this world
and
a happy, prosperous life or eternal life in the afterlife.
Right.
That's the aim. That's the aim of Islam. So Islam came as a package, a complete package. Whatever you need is in there. Whatever it requires, whatever you require for your safety, for your happiness, for whatever you need, for all your problems, all your diseases, are in that system.
Yeah, so I get how you relate that to what you said earlier before the break. You do provide them with, you know, as you said, it doesn't have to be a vegetable. So you do provide them with the utility, utensils, the things that they need to live the perfect and happy life over here, besides the proper software that you install in them for the betterment of the hereafter, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
when we say Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us that system, that software, we need to install it in our kids. For example, like just some of the basic examples, like praying, fasting, morals, akhlaq, you know, not cheating, not lying, not harming other people. These are the simple things that we start teaching our kids from the beginning, that as they grow older, it's like I said, if we can use the same analogy of the program, sometimes like as you work develops, you would require new software as well. So as you move, as a child moves on, we start to give them more and more of these teachings until they reach, for example, puberty. Then it's, we hit them with jurisprudence, with fiqh,
right?
Halal, haram, you can't do this, you can't do that. So it's a continuous process of learning, and which is Islam, until they get to a certain age, and then they have to take on the mission themselves and start, you know, educating themselves. As parents, we are required to get them through the essentials of the ABC of Islam, which is, you know, to be a good person and to become a righteous person and, you know, pray and fast and do all the good things. That's the things that we teach our children. But the idea I'm trying to push here is that as parents, we must have a goal when it comes to our children, and the goal is to make them righteous people, God-fearing people.
So that's
that,
the first.
That is the golden key I'm trying to push here, right?
Okay, yeah.
We have to have that in our minds.
So prioritize that first.
Before anything else, you have to say to yourself, I need to create a pious, righteous child, not a rich child, not a doctor child, not a lawyer child.
Okay, yeah,
No. This you keep aside.
Yeah,
but your first intention, your first goal, when you look at this trust that Allah has given you, is that I need to get to the destination, which is to be righteous and pious.
Yeah.
That's what in the Quran says, لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ.
Right, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the goal, that's the aim as parents that we need to keep in mind. Because if we drift from that goal, then we'll be drinking water without knowing why we're drinking it.
Yeah, you know, right? Yeah, just because it's something new and you just want to taste it. You know?
So this is the key and the point I was trying to make in this whole discussion, that we need to get the goal right. If we don't get the goal right, then we will be walking on different path altogether.
Right, probably trying to walk in water, which, well, we're not Jesus, so we can't do that. Also, there's one thing that I'd like to add is, or actually conclude from your conversation, is that children do not learn when we tell them. They learn what they see. So we have to implement what we are teaching them in our own lives also. I think we're running out of time, so we're going to finish over here and ask. Thank you so much for being here, by the way. Thanks so much. We learned a lot, and we hope on keeping on learning from you. So, dear listeners, if you've got any questions that you might come across and any suggestions, comments, send it to us on englishradio@irib.ir. Visit our website, partstoday.com. That's partstoday.com. And Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram with the name Call of Islam Radio. And please join us in our next program. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life. A way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
In the limelight.
Mark Dullard, founder and chairman of Kids Right, said, apart from patients of the coronavirus, children have been hardest hit, not directly by the virus itself, but fundamentally felt through the deferred actions of governments around the world. We've prepared for you an article written by staff writers of Agence France-Presse News Agency under the heading, Watchdog Says Children Risk Generational Catastrophe from COVID. Thank you. rights group said in an annual survey recently that the coronavirus pandemic has severely affected children's rights worldwide, with young people risking a generational catastrophe if governments do not act. Dutch non-governmental organization Kids Rights said, as it launched its annual ranking, millions of children have missed out on education because of COVID-19 restrictions, while there will be a long-term impact in terms of their physical and mental health. The survey ranks Iceland, Switzerland and Finland as best for children's rights, and Chad, Afghanistan and Sierra Leone as the worst out of a total of 182 countries. Mark Dullard, founder and chairman of Kids Rights, said that the effects of the pandemic on children had unfortunately exceeded our predictions at the outset last year. He said, apart from patients of the coronavirus, children have been hardest hit, not directly by the virus itself, but fundamentally felt through the deferred actions of governments around the world. Mark Dullard added, educational recovery is the key to avoiding generational catastrophe. The group said schools for more than 168 million children have been closed for almost a full year, with one in three children worldwide unable to access remote learning while their schools were shut down. An additional 142 million kids fell into material poverty as the global economy was hit by the coronavirus pandemic, while 370 million kids missed out on school meals. Kids' Rights hailed Bangladesh for taking over a national television channel for homeschooling and praised Belgium and Sweden for trying to keep schools open. Meanwhile, 80 million children under the age of one could miss out on routine vaccination for other diseases because of disruption to healthcare systems. The report said there was also an astonishing increase in domestic violence during lockdowns, with children often ending up as the victims. Kids' Rights included Palestine on its list for the first time, placing it in 104th position due to a focus on healthcare despite difficult circumstances. However, as in previous years, it gave low scores to Britain, Australia, and New Zealand due to a lack of legal protection for children relative to their wealth. Britain and New Zealand were ranked at 169 and 168, respectively, below North Korea, below Syria, Iraq, and Sudan, and just ahead of Eritrea. Austria and Hungary also fell heavily due to discrimination. The survey uses United Nations data to measure how countries measure up to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. Millions of people are losing their lives with no access to vaccines in poor countries, while rich countries are sitting on large caches of surplus vaccines and refusing to share them. The dire situation has prompted a call by several leading organizations for world leaders to make a new commitment to a more equal distribution of coronavirus vaccines. In a letter published on the Washington Post recently, the heads of the World Health Organization, WHO, World Bank, International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Trade Organization, WTO, said, bringing the pandemic to an end requires global action now. They said, it has become abundantly clear that there will be no broad-based recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic without an end to the health crisis, adding, access to vaccination is key to both. The joint opinion editorial called on the group of seven wealthy nations, the G7, to agree on a stepped-up coordinated strategy backed by new financing to vaccinate the world. The leaders of the G7 are due to hold a summit in the United Kingdom later on this month. The joint letter recommended that the G7 agree to fund a $50 billion plan already put forward by the International Monetary Fund to accelerate the end of the coronavirus pandemic. The G7 leaders met in central London recently and committed to financially support the United Nations-backed program COVAX, but there was no immediate announcement of fresh funding or improved access to vaccines. Back in March of this year, the World Health Organization warned against vaccine inequality, which it described as grotesque, calling on vaccine-wealthy nations to refrain from giving shots to children and adolescents and instead donate those vaccine doses to other nations. The World Health Organization said only 14 of the 21 countries in the Eastern Mediterranean region, which extends from Morocco to Afghanistan, have received inoculations, equivalent to little more than 1% of the population of the entire region. In the meantime, the United States has purchased 200 million more vaccines for its own citizens, pushing poorer countries and vulnerable populations to the back of the queue. Foreign leaders have repeatedly called on U.S. President Joe Biden to provide help on accessing coronavirus vaccines. However, the president said his administration would help the rest of the world only after all American citizens have access to the vaccine. Though experts estimate that low-income countries will experience wide access after 2022, they warn that delaying inoculations will allow the virus opportunity to mutate, potentially undermining available vaccines and ultimately a global recovery. Recently, South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa described the situation as tantamount to vaccine apartheid. Cyril Ramaphosa said, "The populations of advanced rich countries are safely inoculated, while millions of people in poorer countries die in the queue." According to the World Health Organization, the Sub-Saharan Africa has administered the fewest vaccines relative to its population of any region, with roughly 8 doses per 1,000 people versus 150 doses per 1,000 people globally. According to data collected by Johns Hopkins University, the pandemic has so far claimed the lives of 3.55 million people worldwide and infected over 170 million people across the world.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
"This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution."
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, "Taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states." He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass-starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions. The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the US blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned. No stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate the conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impacts of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
An open letter by dozens of European officials, the purpose to end unwarranted public criticism of inquiries into alleged Israeli war crimes in Palestine, such as the context of an apparent push by 50 European officials to have the ICC complete its investigation. These officials include former foreign ministers, prime ministers, and senior international officials, including two British Conservative former ministers. Roadblocks were thrown the ICC's way when the inquiry opened. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump sanctioned ICC court officials from pursuing the matter, something the new U.S. administration reversed.
Well, Donald Trump's position was highly criticized by various governments and many other people, because it was, you know, just totally out of line. There's no question in my mind that Israel's committed human rights violations, and to exempt Israel from any sort of scrutiny is a travesty of justice.
The ICC has less to worry about, at least for now. The letter reads that the purpose of the court is well established and recognized, that accountability for serious rights violations by all sides through conflict is essential for achieving sustainable, lasting peace. The key question is, Will the ICC's findings be grounds for holding anyone accountable for prosecution if guilty of war crimes and human rights violations?
Israel's afraid that there will be international warrants issued for various Israeli officials who participated in the planning and directing the attack on Gaza. Gaza is the most densely populated place on the planet. And, you know, if you look at the pictures, you know, whole families were targeted and killed. And it's grossly disproportionate in terms of what the Palestinians were doing. And Israel's attack on Palestinians in Jerusalem was the initial cause of that, which is also very troubling.
The former Danish foreign minister and former president of the UN General Assembly have said a rules-based global order is predicated upon the idea that violations of international law must be met with consequences. The United States and, more importantly, Israel in this case are not members of the ICC, so they do not fall under the ICC's jurisdiction. But the ICC, as an international criminal court, can pursue the rule of law, in this case, violations of human rights in occupied Palestine. The investigation, in many cases, should be an open and shut case, since there are obvious Israeli violations that have taken place over the decades. So many violations that in a recent report, Human Rights Watch called Israel an apartheid regime. This was quite significant since for the first time ever, Human Rights Watch made the informed and evidence-based assessment that the actions of the Israeli regime with regards to its treatment of the Palestinian people has crossed the threshold qualifying it as apartheid.
I certainly concur with Human Rights Watch's assessment. Several Israeli human rights organizations, B'Tselem, have said the same thing. And if you look at the evidence, there is, it's clear that much of the Israeli policy is punitive. In fact, current Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is quoted, saying that how he was going to punish the Palestinians and how they would, squeeze them and actually instigate problems for them so they could reach out and attack the Palestinian population.
Israel finds itself in a precarious state. With no functioning system of governance and isolation on the international stage, it is a very fragile entity. To add to Israel's worry, it's been revealed that the leaders of the resistance groups Hamas and Hezbollah met last year to discuss plans for the liberation of Palestine from the Israeli occupation. The recent blow dealt to Israel during the 11-day Gaza War was also part of the liberation plan. The Palestinian resistance adopted tactics used by Hezbollah during the 2006 war by setting up mock rocket launch sites to deceive the Israeli Air Force. This only means that the Israeli regime's days of violating the Palestinian rights are numbered. Forced evictions, detainment without charge, freedom of movement, home demolitions, and the killing of Palestinians are illegal actions that happen almost on a daily basis. Plus, the three Gaza wars were proof of Israel's disproportionate killing of Palestinians. The question now remains whether a judicial body can prosecute Israel and its officials into obvious cases of war crimes, regardless of the U.S. obstruction of justice in favor of Israel.
When you have former prime ministers, ministers in governments, and high-ranking officials calling for the International Criminal Court to exercise its rights and to investigate war crimes, this is an opportunity to review Israel's actions and, of course, hold them accountable. And there could be warrants issued by the International Criminal Court.
The EU is Israel's biggest trading partner. Of these high-ranking EU officials who really want justice to prevail, they can economically sanction Israel, as called by the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, if Israel does not cooperate with the investigation. Israel faces ever-growing isolation in the international arena and risks continuing with its violations.
Commodities traders in the United States came across something surprising last week when the U.S. Energy Information Agency released its new figures. The EIA figures included Iranian crude oil for the first time in decades. The government statistics and court documents show the U.S. has sold about 2 million barrels of Iranian crude after seizing an oil tanker off the coasts of the United Arab Emirates. American authorities say they brought the Liberian flag tanker Achilles to Houston, Texas in March. It was ordered to discharge its cargo at the port of Galveston. The crude from the oil vessel, which the U.S. says was transporting Iranian oil, was then sold for $110 million. American officials say the tanker was covertly transporting the cargo to China in violation of U.S. sanctions against Iran over its nuclear program. U.S. court documents also allege the vessel was subject to forfeiture under American anti-terrorism statutes. Some observers have described the seizure as illegal under international law and argue that it amounts to piracy.
I mean, it's piracy, it's theft. It's amazing that the United States can appropriate to itself the right to do such things. This exceeds even, you know, the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire was a cruel empire within its boundaries, but it couldn't go outside of its boundaries and tell the rest of the world what to do.
Anti-Iran hawk former U.S. President Donald Trump has been gone for months now. But the United States has kept up its anti-Iran policies under Democratic President Joe Biden. The recent seizure of the oil tanker was a stark reminder that America's anti-Iran measures are not ending. Many such measures were reimposed by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who abandoned the hard-earned 2015 Iran nuclear deal. His successor, Joe Biden, says sanctions are not exactly his favorite, but the anti-Iran measures are being fully enforced under his watch. The Islamic Republic's oil shipping and banking are among the sectors targeted by America's unilateral sanctions. Iran has repeatedly described America's measures as economic war. The American sanction mechanism has made it extremely difficult for Iran to purchase some essential goods like medicines. The American president promised a shift in U.S. policy on Iran, but he has so far failed to fulfill his pledge to change course.
As far as its foreign policy goes, this is truly the neocon foreign policy. These are the actors from the Obama administration, people who had key roles when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State, like Campbell and Sullivan. People who are now in these critical positions inside the administration and Samantha Power at AID and so on and so forth, who really were able to impose the most terrible sanctions on Iran.
The United States and Iran say they are willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran and the remaining parties to the deal, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, have held several rounds of talks in Vienna aimed at restoring the half-dead nuclear deal. Diplomats from the United States have been present in Vienna and talking with their P4+1 counterparts. There have been some signs of progress in Vienna, raising hopes for a revival of the international nuclear agreement. But critics believe that even if the U.S. returns to the deal, past experience shows that there is no guarantee that the U.S. will honor its commitments in the future.
Food insecurity among U.S. veterans and military families has been a problem which has persisted for some time. Not only is this an issue which has not been covered in the mainstream media that often, U.S. policymakers have failed to address it. Veterans of the U.S. are Americans that the U.S. government has used for their foreign policy adventures, especially wars that have been waged. And there has been no shortage of wars when it comes to the U.S.
We veterans become quite dangerous when we become activated and realize the truth and understand that we've been used as pawns in a game for bankers' wars. So we suffer emotionally. The rate of suicide amongst the veterans is 22 a day. That is unreported. And food insecurity, well, that's minor, compared to some of the other issues. We've got some major, major breakdown. America is imploding flat out, and part of it is the breakdown of society, family, and our veterans. They say, thank you for your service, but in truth, we throw them in the gutter.
It was revealed that the U.S. is either directly or covertly involved in more than 80 military incursions across the world under the so-called War on Terror. The Pentagon was sending U.S. troops on missions around the globe to combat what it called violent extremists. The U.S. also has over 800 military bases in 80 countries, so their military personnel is very active. So when these veterans are reported to not have the means to provide themselves with food, that is not only embarrassing for the U.S., but reveals the mindset of U.S. lawmakers who are failing to take care of these veterans. After all, these are the same people that the Pentagon put in harm's way in battlefields across the world.
The politicians are actually doing their job. Their job is not to serve the people. Their job is to serve the bankers. They roll over and do as a dog, well-trained dog, would do for the bankers. They do, everything they do is counter to the interests of the people of America. Name me one thing that America does that is actually in the interest of the people. The best they can do is send out a COVID relief check, which is really just a mild form of bribery, like throwing a dog a bone. The U.S. government does not work for the people. The government is comprised of traitors who, by the legal definition of the word treason, should be charged, convicted, and, according to the law, executed.
According to one study, 6.5% were food insecure between 2011 and 2017. However, other studies show food insecurity among veterans were higher, hovering at around 25%. That is half of the total veteran population of around 18 million. Another sad reality amongst U.S. veterans is the high degree of suicides. That number is said to be between 17 to 23 veterans every day. Although the number is on a downward trajectory, it is still very high. The situation was so severe that in 2013, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs released a study that covered suicides from 1999 to 2010, which showed that roughly 22 veterans were dying by suicide per day, or one every 65 minutes. Some sources suggest that this rate may be undercounting suicides.
There would be no interest in them inflating the numbers. If anything, they will deflate the numbers. So yes, I believe it is far more than 22 a day. You know, my partner, who I'm working with now as a Marine, aside from the suicides, he was in Afghanistan fighting a banker's war, as I was in Iraq, and he stepped on an IED, and his legs were blown off above the knees. Right there, legs gone. He had to deal with all of that and come home, and I can assure you the price he paid was not worth it, and especially when you consider the fact, and he knows this as well as I, we don't fight to defend America.
Why the U.S. government is not paying the close attention and care to veterans has been a subject of debate amongst policymakers. On the one hand, there's a U.S. military budget over $1,700 billion. One would think that some of that should be allocated for veterans. Yet, not only is that not done, veterans are going hungry and are committing suicide daily.
Well, I'll tell you who gets the money, and it ain't the veterans. Israel gets over $10 million a day. That's over $3 billion. That is the richest nation in the Middle East. Meanwhile, the people of Gaza are sucking on the latest slaughter, genocide, torture, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. Again, the American taxpayer is flipping the bill for that. So Israel's doing quite swimmingly, but the veterans in America, oh, sorry, we really don't have much. We're going to spend a bunch of money to send you off to war, but when you come back from war, we will throw you into the trash.
Even the veterans who seek medical attention are not faring that well either. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, which was created to care for military veterans, is reported to be under siege, facing one challenge after another. Extreme wait times for care have been reported, with some not being treated at all as a result. Surely the more than 2 million women and men who served in the U.S. so-called global war on terrorism, which has been waged primarily in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, are now rethinking why they fought for a government that does not care about them, a mindset that will be passed on to others in the U.S.
فقه و جورسپروڈنس is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
الإخوان من تكلف له شر الإخوان من تكلف له حديث از امير المؤمنين.
In a beautiful hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam states, the first kind of guest is the one for whom the host bears hardship and difficulty. By hardship, we mean the host tries hard to prepare more than what he really can afford, or to borrow money from this and that, so that he can invite a guest to his house. Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, I love three things. One is feeding the guest, the second is fighting with sword, and the third one is fasting during summertime. As you can see, Imam Ali alayhi salam likes to invite the guest to his house.
چقدر الان مهمانی ها کم شده، چقدر رفت و آمد ها کم شده به خاطر این.
However, when compared with today's etiquettes of invitation, you can find that how complicated and difficult it is for the people to invite each other to their houses. The main reason is takalluf or pretentious behavior of the people to show as if they are rich. When we look at previous generations, we can see how much simple were their gatherings and meetings. Sometimes during a year, two brothers cannot invite each other because they try hard to do the bad things and they cannot afford it, so they leave the very nature of invitation itself and meeting the kinsfolk itself. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Nasser Rafi'i. To find out about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/Ian Kalav Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
the light.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
Those are patients.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under full control in India. In Russia, drone enthusiasts have gathered in the capital, Moscow, to show off their technological creativity in a racing competition. The participants created their own drones and made changes to the models right on the site where the competition was held to improve their chances to win the contest. The goal was for the participants to complete the track in the shortest possible time. Participants say the interesting thing about the competition is that it's cheaper than other games.
It's a lot of fun. From the outside, it may not be so clear, but when you're inside it, it becomes really fun to talk, race with the competitors, learn from their experience some new technological things. As for the high cost, it is expensive, but when compared with the snowboards and skis, it is really cheaper, but more expensive than knitting.
In 2017, the International Federation of Aeronautics, or FAI, announced drone racing as an official sport. In 2018, Russia's sports ministry included drone racing in all Russian register of sports with a class code F3U following the FAI classification. Nowadays, phone addiction is causing an increasing number of accidents worldwide. A Korean engineer has come up with a creative, although satirical, way to tackle that issue. Pang Min-wung is a 28-year-old industrial designer. He has invented a robotic eyeball people can wear to avoid accidents when using their phones while walking. The device is strapped to the forehead and opens its eyelids when the users lower their heads. The third eye then beeps in warning when the user comes within 1 or 2 meters of an obstacle. Peng says his device is not a solution to the issue and hopes that people will understand the severity of their reliance on gadgets when they see the third eye.
A science professor has released spectacular drone footage of lava streaming from an Icelandic volcano. Sørensen Johnson flew a drone over the volcano 2 months after it started erupting. He captured close-up shots of lava bubbling in its crater in the southwest of Iceland's capital. The volcanologists say that they have no idea how long this eruption will continue, adding that magma could flow for years. Iceland is home to dozens of active volcanoes. Volcanic landscapes have turned into a tourist attraction in the Scandinavian country. Two Russian cosmonauts have conducted spacewalk outside the International Space Station to prepare an old docking module for disposal. The duo spent more than 7 hours outside the ISS to wrap up preparations for the eventual disposal of the Pris docking compartment. According to NASA officials, the Russian cargo freighter will remove the two-decade-old module from the orbiting laboratory later this summer. Both the cargo ship and the Pris will burn up in the atmosphere above the Pacific Ocean. The orbiting Pris will clear the way for the arrival of a new Russian multipurpose laboratory module named Nuka, meaning science in Russian. Nuka is scheduled to launch on July the 15th this year. Wednesday's operation was the sixth spacewalk in 2021 in support of the space station assembly, maintenance, and upgrades.
A rare albino baby elephant that was rescued from poachers in South Africa has found a new home with a welcoming herd. The calf, named Han Yi Sa, was caught in a snare in the Kruger National Park when she was only 4 months old. She suffered several nasty wounds, including one to her mouth. Han Yi Sa remained trapped in the snare for 4 days before being rescued and taken to a shelter especially built for elephants northeast of Johannesburg. All the other elephants there are orphans too.
Each female that we had has a baby. So except for them, all of the others are orphaned. And I think that is part of the reason why they accept these orphans, because they know how it feels, you know, and they become actually, you know, the mother figures for them.
The calf has learned to adapt to the new life. She lies under the shadow cast by bigger elephants to protect herself from getting sunburnt. The shelter says if the herd grows too big for the area, she and other elephants will be released into the wild.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A Brazilian artist has found a way to reuse plastic bags in a very creative way, making something beautiful out of them. Eduardo Sroa turns recycled shreds of plastic into real pieces of artwork. He picks up the material from city streets and rivers. Without using a drop of paint, Sroa recreates paintings by Picasso, Van Gogh, and other famous artists. He says his goal is to draw attention to plastic pollution.
I present this series as a product that does not have paint, except for what has already been processed into plastic by the industry. It does not have glue. It is a box that was built, and inside I press and condense it. I make an accumulated cluster of plastic bags that ends up creating this image that you see.
Sura's exhibition is due to open in Sao Paulo in the coming months. His previous works were also aimed at raising awareness about the environment. He has created several giant installations in public places, mostly along polluted rivers.
Chinese archaeologists have unearthed a rare 3,000-year-old bronze figure from a site they have been excavating for months in Sichuan province. The 1.5-meter figure, deemed one of China's most famous archaeological discoveries. It consists of two parts. The upper part is 55 centimeters high, with a zoon, a vessel used in ancient times, on top of the head. The lower part is 60 centimeters in size, with kneeling posture. Similar findings in the past were just 20 centimeters in their heights. The bronze figure was discovered under massive ivory objects. So far, over 500 objects, including ivory, bronze, gold, and jade ware, have been found from six sacrificial pits of the Sanjiangdu ruins.
Chinese man becomes the first blind Asian mountaineer to successfully scale the world's tallest peak, the Mount Everest. Zhang Hong completed the 8,849-meter high Himalayan feat with three high-altitude guides. The 46-year-old climber said he spent much of his trek holding onto his guide's arm. The pair said the most tiresome and risky areas were the so-called death zones, ice walls, and ice falls at around 8,000 meters. The Chinese climber recalled humbly embracing being part of Mother Nature after he completed his arduous journey.
No matter if you're disabled or normal, whether you have lost your eyesight or you have no legs or hands, it doesn't matter. As long as you have a strong mind, you can always complete anything that other people think you can't.
Zhang added that this is only the beginning. He said his next milestone is climbing the highest peaks from the world's continents known as the Seven Summits. The Chinese mountaineer lost his eyesight at the age of 21. After his success, he became the third visually impaired person to ever step foot on the Everest peak. A Russian company has developed a fully self-driving car that looks like it was taken right out of a sci-fi movie. Flip is the size of a conventional passenger car and has enough space for six people. Its creator says the advanced vehicle is a taxi of the future. Flip has fulfilled the requirements of international automated driving standards. It's powered by electricity, but it can also use other fuels like gas and hydrogen. The owners of this futuristic vehicle do not have to worry about running out of power. That's because its replaceable batteries can be changed in less than 5 minutes once they are out of electricity. A rare baby giraffe is born in a zoo in western France as conservationists try to increase the population of this endangered species. The cute Rothschild giraffe is the second born in the French zoo this year. Caretakers say the calves will stay with the facility for 1 year before they would be sent to another site to start their own families. The Rothschild giraffes are critically endangered, and conservationists say that only 1,600 of them exist now. The general giraffe populations in the wild have also decreased by around 30% in the last three decades.
For many professional climbers, ascending Mount Everest for even once remains an almost distant dream. However, a Nepali man has achieved that feat not once or twice, but 25 times. Kami Rita Sherpa has arrived back in the capital, Kathmandu, after breaking his own whopping record of 24 ascents to the summit of the world's tallest mountain. The veteran climber hopes that his accomplishment represents a big achievement for his small country. Climbing tall mountains runs in Kami's blood. He belongs to the Sherpa tribe, one of the Tibetan ethnic groups and native to the most mountainous region of Nepal.
Now, the iconic Eiffel Tower in Paris has been illuminated for the first time using electricity produced from certified renewable hydrogen. In an amazing show, hydrogen-generated lights were projected onto the tower's frames, displaying various patterns and designs, making viewers ecstatic. It's a dream project of a French company based in the city of Saint-Malo. The company wanted to make the most recognizable landmark a showcase for its carbon-free technology. The objective is to bring more awareness of renewable energy to the public. The nightly event will continue until May the 30th. Countries around the world are investing a lot to develop hydrogen-related technologies.
www.parstoday.com /EN.